and we're just recording the show. Thank goodness Sarah has a brain, because I certainly don't. Anyway, joining me today in studio is Nancy Smith, a community activist, protester. She has just been released from prison after 6 months, and we'll find out why. And then we'll also be starting off with Bob Elmendorf, who is on the phone, who'll be talking about the 50th anniversary of Powell House right here in Columbia County. If you don't know what Powell House is, stay tuned. He'll tell you about it. And there's a wonderful celebration going on Saturday, the 27th, from 10 to 10 p.m. So hang in there with us for another edition of Tell It Like It Is. Okay, so we're going to start off with Bob Elmendorf, and let's see if we can get Bob on the phone. Bob, can you hear us?
Yes, can you hear me?
I can, Bob. Just talk directly into the phone. It's a little fuzzy, but I think we can make out what you're saying.
Can you hear me okay now?
That's better, Bob. And just as I said, if you can speak up, and the phone always makes your voice a little bit quieter on the air, but I think we can hear you. Nancy's okay. With us. And just wanted to say a quick hello to Nancy. And okay, Bob, can you tell us about, first of all, who you're on the board of directors of Powell House and what is going on there?
Okay, this Saturday we're having a community open house to celebrate our 50th anniversary. Powell House was gifted to New York Yearly Meeting in 1960 by the Powell family. So we have been continuously running programs there for 50 years, and we're having a celebration that we're inviting all the community to, and it's going to go on Saturday, October 27th, from 10 in the morning.
You mean August? August 27th, right, Bob?
August, I meant to say.
Yes. Go ahead.
Okay, and I'll just tell you a little bit about what's going to be going on that day. There's a huge pond, and so there's a big swimming area. They're going to have arts and crafts and games. Lunch will be at 12:30, dinner will be at 6. There'll be a concert at 3:30 by George Woods, and he's a guitarist. There'll be a hike to a Dorsen's Rock that's up in a bird refuge above Powell House. Then there's a cabaret at 7:30 at night. And then there's going to be a bonfire after that. And that should just about do it, I think.
And Bob, is this is open to the public?
Yes, it is open to the public. It's $10 per person or $25 for a family.
Okay. And Bob, what is, first of all, where is Powell House located?
Okay, Powell House is located in Old Chatham in Columbia County. It's on Pitt Hall Road, which is off of County Route 13 in Columbia County. And the website is Powell House. powellhouse.org. And the phone number is 794-8811, area code 518.
So, Bob, why would folks in Columbia County want to go, besides just being cordial, why would they want to go to Powell House? What is the role of Powell House in the peace movement? What does Powell House represent?
Well, Powell House has all kinds of different conferences there. They've been having conferences there for maybe as long as 50 years. They have several different kinds. Some conferences are just for Quakers. It's where Quaker meetings have their, like there are a lot of Quaker meetings in New York State and in New Jersey and Connecticut. That's all part of what they call New York Yearly Meetings. They go there and they have their retreats. Of course, those are closed for that meeting. But then there are general conferences that Powerhouse has that can be of interest to the community, either on spiritual topics or peace and justice topics. And if we feel that the community would be interested, then I'm and help out on publicity and help the staff out on that, and I'll make posters, you know, and advertise it to the media.
Okay. Well, Bob, you know what? Thank you so much for being on the air. We're having a little difficulty hearing you, but I will definitely give out the information again at the end of the show. And
okay, then.
Thank you so much, Bob, for coming on this morning.
All right. Thank you, Christina.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye. Okay, and that was Bob Elmendorf, one of the board of directors of Powell House, Quaker Meeting Conference Center, and I've been to a number of talks there, and I personally would like to stress the peace and social justice issues. There were a lot of good speakers there, and I think it's a beautiful setting, and if people want to find out more about it, again, you can go to powellhouse.org. or call 794-8811. And so, welcome, Nancy. Nancy Smith.
Hi, Christina.
I just want to tell folks that Nancy Smith was on the show sometime last January, I think it was, and she was talking about her activism in relationship to the School of the Americas, which is now called WINSEC, or the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security. And she was talking about the fact that she was ready, that she has participated in a protest in Georgia, where Fort Benning is, and she crossed the line and wound up being arrested and going to prison. Nancy, can you pick up the rest of the story from
it
there?
It seems a long time since you and I talked at this radio station.
Yeah.
It's really only been a little more than 6 months, but it was a long 6 months.
Yeah. And Nancy, what caused, first of all, can you tell us about what the School of the Americas is and why you were down in Georgia protesting them?
Yeah, I'm happy to do that again, and to everyone that I speak with here. A lot of people in the Northeast don't know anything at all about the School of the Americas, although people in the South know much more. And that's because the School of the Americas is located at Fort Benning, Georgia, and it's operated and run by the U.S. Army and funded, I should remind you, by U.S. taxpayers. The task of the School of the Americas, now known as WINSEC, has been to, in support of U.S. foreign policy, has been the place where our government trained soldiers and police from Central American and Latin and South American countries in counterinsurgency techniques such as torture, assassination, extortion. The graduates of this School of the Americas over now probably four decades have been involved on behalf of their own countries with murder, rape, and a whole string of human rights abuses, including assassination of mostly non-combatants, people who are labor organizers, union activists, teachers, university professors, all activists who are involved in social and economic justice issues, journalists, priests, nuns, teachers. A few of these School of the Americas atrocities are well known. In 1980, for example, the Archbishop of El Salvador, Oscar Romero, was assassinated by a team that were trained at this School of Americas. So it's not just saying that it's a bad thing, the School of the Americas, but this, it has been, we know who's been trained, and we've traced their activities back in their countries to those who have been trained by U.S. Army and at Fort Benning at the School of the Americas, or SOA. There are so many other victims of the School of the Americas whose names and faces are and will continue to be unknown. For example, more than 700 men, women, and children who were massacred in the village of El Mozote, El Salvador, again, and thousands who have been killed or disappeared in Colombia during the past several years, or who were lost in Guatemala and Argentina, all over South America and Central America. The work of these men from army and police and also civilians who were trained at that school have discredited the United States to the extent that this action that I was involved in has been organized by an organization called SOA Watch. It is a nonprofit organization whose work is to track the work of SOA, School of the Americas, to know what they're doing, to know how many people are coming there, from what countries, and what they do when they go back home. And the result of this has been an absolutely marvelous organization and an action that takes place annually.
If you go to the School of the Americas website, SOA Watch, or you can just Google SOA, it'll come up. You're right, the documentation on that website as a witness of what the consequences of this training is well documented there for people to see. My question to you, Nancy, is why does the U.S. do this? Why do they support this? What's the interest in supporting this military training facility?
Yeah, that's a very important question because, well, let me say first of all that SOA Watch itself is organized and sustained by an absolutely wonderful person, Father Roy Bourgeois, who is a Mary Knoll priest, has been the leader of this group and the sustaining spiritual member of this group for so many years. And I want to just read you a quote I saw for the first time the other day because he responds to that question perhaps much better than I could. What he says is that When the fact of the abuses that have been committed by graduates of this school, when that's contextualized in a long history of graduates committing human rights abuses, exposes the lie that the SOA WINSEC supports democracy and is contributing positively to the, quote, war on drugs, unquote, in the hemisphere. That's from Roy Bourgeois. And also he says the truth of that is that it's an institution used to prop up regimes who are in alignment with U.S. economic interest at any cost. So people are simply astounded when we talk about the fact that we are training people in these kinds of techniques. And in a sense, it's a shock to them that this happens, not because we're bad people or we agree with torture, but that it's in our economic interest to do that. And I find that just horrifying. It's to support companies that do business in South America and to get the right kinds of support from dictatorships who are assaulting their own people. So I think it's important to understand that this is part of U.S. foreign policy. And as we see in other places of the world, that policy includes military aid, military equipment aid, training aid. Look at how we're managing situations in Afghanistan and other places around the world where our aid is not in the form of help to people or to support civil organizations or support for grade school teacher training, for example, rather than training in assassination and torture.
So this under the guise of the war, specifically in South America, under the guise of the war on drugs, Colombia, Ecuador, Guatemala, companies, U.S. companies, corporations, interests are being advanced by mercenaries, exported mercenaries, in a sense.
Yeah, who are highly trained and who go back to their home countries and become, often as not, part of elite battalions who are very specially directed against any kind of organization that appears to be destabilizing for the government itself. And that includes, as I've said, labor organizers, union activists. It includes poor farmers in rural areas who are trying to get together and get themselves a better deal or trying to preserve their access to the land. University professors, students, all of these people have been the victims of the School of the Americas and the victims of this kind of training. So it's not just having strong armies or strong police. It's a question of what we select to, how we select to offer aid to mm-hmm. another country. And again, it's part of the militarization of our foreign aid. Look for that when you hear what's going on and when you hear what the United States is doing in other countries. It's an important part of what we do, and invariably it involves military aid of some sort.
Nancy, when the School of the Americas changed its name to the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security. It was renamed in 2001. Mm-hmm. Why did they do that? I think,
It was a cosmetic change. I think that SOA became so notorious both overseas and here in the U.S. In Spanish. People in Latin American countries refer to it as the School of the Assassins, and it's become so notorious because of the people who go back home and carry out these assassinations. So the idea of WINSEC was to sort of cloak what's really going on there, but it was cosmetic only, and there was a short-lived publicity campaign to make people think that WINSEC was a great way to offer aid to foreign countries, but it has not changed anything, and has not changed the curriculum that's being taught, or the number of people who've been coming. Over 60,000 people, men mostly, maybe entirely actually, but I'm not sure about that. 60,000 people have been trained in these techniques. Techniques which, if done by American police or army, would be court actioned, and that doesn't happen in Latin American countries. The other thing that's happening with graduates of this school is that increasingly they're moving out of the army and police forces of a number of countries and turn up in drug cartels. So not only do they carry out political moves for the government, but they're also strengthening the skills which we find in drug cartels and making them more efficient and effective.
So, ironically, yeah.
Yeah. How do you like that one?
Mm. what I want to ask is right now with Obama in the White House, what is the stance of this administration? I noted on the website that it's asking people to write and call President Obama to shut down the School of the Americas. Can you tell me a little bit about what his position is?
Every year, SOA mounts a big demonstration in Washington also to move legislation through Congress which would reduce the amount of funding the School of the Americas get, and hopefully in a tight budget year erase it entirely. This has been going on for years, and sometimes the vote on passage of that legislation has been very, very close. And I'm not sure what has happened in this year. This year I was in prison when that came up for a vote, and I'm sorry I don't have that figure for you.
No, that's fine. But there is definitely, do you feel this is the administration that could make the difference?
I would hope so, but we felt that way about Obama on a lot of things. And he needs to hear from us about this. He needs to hear from lots of people. And that's one of the things that happens when I'm able to talk on the radio or take some time and spend it in jail. It increases the number of people who hear about the issue. And of those, we hope that there will be ones who will write to their congressman and push for passage of legislation that will change this. Obama will support that, I'm sure. But he's got to hear from Congress first.
Well, I want to bring this right back home to Columbia County, Greene County, which this station, this community station represents. You are a neighbor. You live here in Columbia County. You have for many years. Why? First of all, two-part question. Can you tell us a little bit of who you are and why you got involved in this issue?
Well, that's...
Sorry.
That's all right.
What I'm trying to do is give people who are listening right now an idea of why it's important to be involved. And you're a representative who really, not only did you become involved, but you really put it on the line. You went to jail for 6 months. And so before we even go to the jail issue, I just...
Yeah, it always embarrasses me a little bit. But anyway, sorry. I have lived in the county for almost 45 years now. I live in Claverick, and part of that time I taught at Columbia Green Community College, and I taught there, and actually during the time that I taught there, I began to was quite interested in international development, and began to work on the fringes of that. And then during a sabbatical year, and a leave of absence, I worked in Southeast Asia, in Cambodia, and Vietnam for the American Friends Service Committee, a Quaker service organization. And then after I left the college, I was full-time employed by a number of different international development organizations, and worked in places like West Africa, Ghana, Togo, Burkina Faso, Niger, and then also in Somalia, with Oxfam UK. Both of those, I worked for Oxfam, British Oxfam, which is the mother ship. and then after Somalia, I was in Nepal for a couple of years, and then to Iraq, and Afghanistan. So I've seen a lot of what happens with and how American foreign policy is perceived overseas, particularly in those that have involved the U.S. military. So I did that, and was overseas about 15 years and came back and worked at a little retreat center in Western Massachusetts. And now I'm not working anymore. I'm 79 years old. And so it's a good thing to do when you're not working anymore is to go and sit in prison for a while. And I think more of us should do that.
Fantastic. I mean, it's not fantastic that you're in prison, but it's quite an experience.
I really have to say that I'm blessed to have been able to do that. It was not easy, and not everybody can do it. But I was in a position to do it, and I'm so happy that I did that. Really, I had experiences that were just extraordinary, and I learned things I never would have learned had I not done it.
Well, Nancy, I think we're going to take a quick break, and then I'd like you to talk about actually how the arrest occurred, what your thinking was behind crossing the line, and how you pleaded, and why you wound up in prison and that prison experience. Because I think a lot of folks do not have a connection to what prison is, and there's a very large portion of our population that actually is in prison, and in this country it's really enormous. So we'll be right back.
Great.
Thank you.
Well, I won't back down. No, I won't back down. You can stand me up at the gates of hell, but I won't back down. Gonna stand my ground, won't be turned around. And I'll keep this world from dragging me down. Gonna stand my ground, and I won't back down. Hey, baby, there ain't no easy way out. Hey, I will stand my ground, and I won't back down. Well, I know what's right. I got just one life. In a world that keeps on pushing me around, but I stand my ground, and I won't back down. Hey, baby, there ain't no easy way out. Hey, I will stand my ground, and I won't back down. No, I won't back down.
Okay, and that was a little Johnny Cash with I Won't Back Down. And we're back. This is Christina Malisoff. This is Tell It Like It Is. Every Thursday from 10 to 11 on WGXC Community Radio. I'm here with Nancy Smith. I'm very honored that she has come back to be on the program. Nancy was arrested earlier this year and spent 6 months, part of it in federal penitentiary. Nancy, can you, two-part question, can you tell us what informed your decision to cross the line, so to speak, and to get arrested, and also talk about what your experience was in prison?
Yeah, I'm really happy for the opportunity to be able to talk about it a little bit. I've been an activist for a long time, but now that I'm not working, I find I have a lot more time to do those things. And one of the ways in which I've expressed my activism is is that I've walked. I walk with a Buddhist group that supports peace and a nuclear-free future. And in the last couple of years, I've walked over 2,000 miles, carrying banners and banging drums and just, in a sense, standing up for the kinds of things that I believe in a way that I can do it. There are lots of ways in which people can get involved in things they believe in. And that's true for this Buddhist group, the Nippon Zanmyo Hoje that I work with. And it's also true for ordinary people. When you call your congressman or congresswoman, or when you hold a sign someplace, like in the 7th Street Park in Hudson, when we vigil from every Saturday afternoon, it's making a statement about the things that you believe in a way that you can. Not everybody can take the time out of their lives to go to prison, but it's a long and honored activity in the United States, civil disobedience and becoming a prisoner of conscience. And as you look at people around the world that we admire, from Gandhi to Martin Luther King, all of them spent time in prison. I'm not drawing analogies between those people and myself. My what I did was a very small thing. But We have opportunities to become activists. Put a piece of it into your lives from time to time and try it out. You'll meet all kinds of wonderful people who are walking that path. Anyway, I had thought about it for a long time and wondered whether or not, now that I didn't have work responsibilities on a daily basis, whether or not it would be something I could do. So it wasn't a rash decision. I'd been thinking about it for a long time. And then the year before, in 2009, I went for the first time to the event, to the demonstration at Fort Benning, which is held every year and is organized by SOA Watch. It's an absolutely wonderful demonstration. I don't think I've ever been to one that's as moving as that one is. There are thousands and thousands and thousands of people who come every single year for a weekend to demonstrate at the gates of Fort Benning, to demonstrate in opposition to the School of the Americas and the results of the expenditure of U.S. money to train people who have committed such atrocities and who have affected the lives of thousands upon thousands of people in Latin America. So when I saw people coming from not only from all around the United States, but from Latin American countries also, so grateful that they could hear people in the United States who were different from their expectations. Actually, they had thought that if you were an American citizen, that it was okay to train people in assassination and waterboarding and techniques like that. So we have a chance to meet there, and it was a wonderful experience for me. And I began to think about whether or not I could cross the line, which is the phrase that's used by SOA Watch. And at that particular demonstration, what that means is that you cross over the barrier the government has erected between the outside world and Fort Benning property. And that barrier now is chain link fence topped by a really high one, topped by razor wire, and guards all over the place. And for the demonstration, there are helicopters circling, and everybody who's at the demonstration is on video all the time, cameras going all the time. This is an absolutely non-violent demonstration. And you take a pledge to be non-violent. There is no fighting. There's no throwing things. It's an absolutely wonderful, wonderful demonstration. So I had been in conversation with SOA Watch about questions that I had about what will happen if I cross the line. How do you do that? Do you dig a hole under the fence? Do you have to pole vault over it? Or how do you get in? And what would happen to me if I did? The kinds of questions that you might have if you think about doing that. And what would be the consequences for me? And I decided that the hardest part would be not being able to quite imagine what it would be like to be in prison. So a watch and their lawyers are very clear that if you cross the line, you're going to get caught and you're going to get sentenced. You could be charged and sentenced, and for sure you'll do prison time. That had been the experience for this group over many, many years. And actually, I think these are the correct figures. They have had over the last 15 or 16 years, 262 people who have done time in prison around this issue, for a total of 100 years of prison time has been spent on this issue. And when you did you have any idea how much that costs? I mean, it is a fabulous amount of money. Mm. Our prison system is horrendously expensive. Anyway, so you have to cross the line, and that during the weekend of the protest is when crossing the line happens. And every year, some people come forward and do that. So meets with it, people, make sure that they understand the consequences of doing that, and make sure that they have all the information they need. So on the Saturday of that weekend, Father Louis and I, he's a Franciscan priest who has crossed that line three previous times. So this was his fourth time crossing it. He's my age, tall, skinny guy with gray hair. We just walked down the ramp and tried to get in the gate of Fort Benning at another location away from where the demonstration was. And within a minute, there were police cars all over us with flashing lights. And the two of us were handcuffed and put into the back of a police car and driven for processing onto the base, where we were processed by the Department of Defense police. These are civilians. This is not military police. These are civilians. So we were processed, which means they take your information, name, address, social security number, that kind of stuff, fingerprint, photograph. And then we were put in a holding cell while bail was arranged. We had already made arrangements. I had put up money for my bail that was being held by SOA lawyers. And so people came, and within an hour and a half, we were out on bail.
Did you know ahead of time did you make that decision, or was it something you made while you were there?
I made the final decision while I was there, because I had an opportunity to sit face to face with both the lawyers and the organizers for SOA Watch. We had a big meeting Friday evening. I was ready to go. I just wasn't sure how to do it. So when they talked about that, then I said, okay, I'm going to go. So both Father Louis and I knew that the two of us would be, and then there were two other younger guys who crossed the fence the next day. They jumped. They went up a ladder on one side and crawled over and jumped down. So everybody, all four of us, were picked up immediately. Father Louis and I were out on bail. And what I needed to do then, what I had planned to do, was to come back home to Columbia County and close up the house and make final arrangements for somebody to, you know, to look after it and get my life in order. And then I took the train back down to Georgia on January 5th for my court appearance. And at the court appearance, that was the trial. Judge Hiles, who was new on that bench, gave all four of us 6 months in prison. Prior to that, Judge Faircloth, although there were problems with him, for example, he read the newspaper while people were making their statements about why they did this. He often gave out three-month sentences, not all the time. But this time was 6 months. Everybody got 6 months right off the bat. So that's where it started. But I had wonderful support all along. There were lots of people in the courtroom who were friends, and lots of good legal support, which for me was very important.
And that 6 months was from, was it from January to?
From January to July 1st.
Right. Okay, Nancy, and we've got about 15 minutes left. I want to talk about your prison experience. I have a quote here that I actually found on the SOA Watch website. And I would like you to read it. Sorry to put you on the spot, but I found it really moving.
I remember writing all of, for those of you who are not right here in this room, I sent a series of notes from prison that my good friend Kavita mailed out to various mail lists. And all of these things are written with a pen on my knee sitting on my bunk. So it's funny to read them now typed out. So this is something I wrote. Anyway, this is what I said. My out date is 1st July, and I'm thrilled to be going home. But with that is an immense sadness to be leaving. This is a place of dreadful futility. Almost nothing of value can happen here. If it does, it's because of the strength and persistence of individual women who have found ways to survive. It's just heartbreaking to know women in their 30s who will be here for the rest of their lives. Others who have no place to go back to, and so many who will return to the same streets and circumstances that got them here in the first place. Yeah, just reading that, Christina, makes me remember what that felt like. And I think every day of the women that I came to know, the dreadfulness and the futility of day after day after day in prison.
Yeah. Well, you talked about the prison industrial complex. You touched on that earlier. I think there's a lot of folks who don't have direct experience with prison. Can you give us a feel for what it was like? Did you feel reformed or...
No, actually, I think it didn't change me, not in the way that Judge Hiles had in mind.
Thank
in
goodness.
Any case. In some ways, it was more comfortable than I had anticipated. Let me just say, I was in three different prisons. From court, I was taken to Irwin County Detention Center, which is in Georgia. Which is a privately owned prison, a for-profit prison. And that's really important to take note of. Mm-hmm. It's happening all over the country. It's big, very big business. These prisons earn money for the owners of the prisons. They're not state-operated. They're not government-operated. Mm-hmm. The federal government, because I was convicted in a federal court, the federal government has no oversight on those prisons, except at a very, very big distance, and most of it is financial. That is, how much are they going to have to pay this prison to hold me for 24 hours? And it's a lot of money. And so it behooves the prison to cut costs wherever they can. And they do that in two ways, and that is by contracting out food services. So they get the least expensive food that will pass dietary muster. And secondly, by contracting out medical services. So it's very hard to get pills out of that system. And if you have complaints, who do you go to? You can't go to the warden because he doesn't supervise medication and he doesn't supervise food services. So he's not interested in whether you like the food or not. So you just have to suck it up. You just have to do it. And so that was Osceola. That prison is located in Osceola. But I came also through this to know a lot about the iniquities of private prisons. And you're going to hear more and more and more about it. It's not a business that a privately operated for-profit organization should be in. It's like privatizing the military. We've heard a lot about that, too. Mm. I forgot your question. think I got off track.
No. But you're giving a sense of what we were talking. I jokingly said something about the reform, or I mean, it's just the vacancy of being in jail.
Yeah. One of the things that happens is that you become part of a group in a way that we're not used to. That is, you're depersonalized. Everything that you own, everything that you have on your body is taken from you. And that was true for all three institutions that I was in. I was in Danbury for 4 months and transferred there from Oklahoma and transferred to Oklahoma from Georgia. So Georgia, Oklahoma, Danbury. But at each entry point, you're stripped naked, all cavities searched thoroughly, and then you're handed out new sets of clothing so that there is not even a small piece of paper with a couple of phone numbers on it can you take with you. Nothing, absolutely nothing. And that includes things like earrings and rings that you normally wear, don't take off. You're just, there's nothing about you except your physical body, which is permitted to be in prison. And that happens at each point. So, okay, so you get through that. But then prison, like other total institutions, I don't know if you remember reading Irving Goffman, wonderful sociologist who wrote about total institutions, places like U.S. Army, like prisons, like summer camps, boarding schools. The whole process is to make you exactly like everybody else. Whether that is just uniforms, whether that's everybody eating the same things. And so you do that here in prison, too. There's very strict regulations about what clothes you have, and those are always issued by the prison itself. In Danbury, for example, we had khaki shirts and khaki pants, and you're issued a couple of each so that you can put them in the laundry. In Osceola, I was in stripes, a one-piece thing that buttoned up the top, gray striped. So I spent the day and the night in that thing. I was there for 6 weeks. And periodically you get to send it out to have it washed. Underwear, socks, shoes, everything is regulated. Everything is prison issued. At Danbury, for example, between 7 in the morning and 5 in the afternoon, you had to have your shirt tucked in and buttoned up. It was a little more relaxed on Saturday and Sunday. Basically, the idea is to have everybody exactly alike. And of course, that produces a consequent reaction in prisoners, which is to identify themselves in very different ways. So one of the things they do is to alter their prison clothing. They sew up the sides so that they cling a little more than the khaki shirt should normally, or they lower the neckline in some kind of innovative way. Or they do their hair in absolutely wild and fantastic ways. You can see what people do to try to become themselves and to be who they are in prison. But the prison always pushes back in making sure that you look like everybody else.
Nancy, you had a support system and you knew you were getting out. For those who you came in contact with that you got close to for the time that you were there, how did that differ from your own personal experience?
You know, Christina, I learned about time in a way that I'll never, ever forget. You're right. I 6 months is a very short period of time. There were times when it felt endless. I'm not going to say that. But that's nothing compared to 5 years, 18 years. And those women that were there for life, the rest of their lives would be spent in that unit. on that schedule. Breakfast at 6:15, lunch at 11 o'clock, dinner at 5:30. For the rest of their lives, they'll be on that schedule. And that was horrifying to me. Never again will I read newspaper accounts of somebody who got sentenced to 3 years and think, oh, well, that's just a short time. That's okay. That is not okay. It is not okay. And it's not okay because nothing good comes of it, except that our society feels as though we've hurt people in some way, which is a kind of retribution for the harm that they did. And what's happened to our prison system now, and I'm going to just be sure that we have time to just say this a little bit, is that our prisons are just loaded, overfilled with people who have been convicted for long, long sentences for nonviolent crimes. Nonviolent crimes, and particularly those that are in because of drug convictions, which are mandatory convictions with mandatory sentences. That does not prevent drug use in the country. It has not reduced drug use in this country. People have become very ingenious in figuring out how to do those things. And invariably, the people they pick up are addicts, not the manufacturers of the drugs or the importers of the drugs. So it has just filled our prisons. And in this instance, with women who have been accused of being a co-conspirator because they drove a car someplace. Now, I'm not naive. I know that people aren't there for selling Bibles door to door. But I think we need to look at where we put our resources. Invariably, people go back to the same neighborhood they came from, and some of those neighborhoods are horrible places, and we know that. Look at our capital in Washington, D.C. What happens on the streets there? How children grow up there? It's a horrible, horrible place. And the D.C. girls, as they're called in prison, really have a hard way to go. And because it was a women's prison, many, many of those women have left children behind.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it destroys children's lives. Mm-hmm. And the women are frantic because the children are with family members that are not particularly reliable, or in foster care, again, not reliable. And so what you get is this multi-generational turnover. I met women, particularly in Osceola, whose parents and grandparents had all spent time in prison. How can we do that? How can we not know how to intervene in that? Mm. How come we're still willing to punish people when we could, when we know it doesn't work? It just staggers my imagination, really does.
It almost seems to be a parallel to what the School of the Americas does in the corporate interest in South America. We're doing internally in our own country.
Exactly. And as it's becoming increasingly privatized, then the parallel is strengthened.
Right. Yeah. Nancy, we only have another minute, really, and I can't believe how fast the time's going by. But in wrapping this up, I want to talk about activism just for a second. I know you believe strongly in what you're doing because you went to jail for it. I feel that there are a lot of folks who are activists in the face of maybe thinking that they have to do something in the world to make a difference, even though they may not have very much hope for changing the world. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, it's a dichotomy in me. It's a split in me that I can't really understand. I don't think we're going to cure this in a hurry. I think we're on a slippery slope. I mean, not only our national political discussions, but morally and spiritually. And I say that I don't think the good guys are going to win this one. But But I also am filled with hope. And it's because it's possible to play a role in that. If you do nothing, you're also playing a role in that slippery slope. If you do something, then it supports that hope that you have. And I have a lot of hope. I've met a lot of people who work on this day and night. Other people who do really innovative things. I met a woman who writes every single day to President Obama. Every single day. That's part of her life. Like you eat your oatmeal in the morning, she writes her letter. A personal letter every day. And she's decided that's what she's going to do. I don't have that kind of organization in my life to do that. So I did what I could do. It's one of the things I could do. People say, "Are you going? You ain't coming back again, are you, Miss Nancy?" They said to me in prison. Yeah. And they said, "I don't know. Not right away, but it's one of the things that I can do." And so I think there are lots of ways that people can do.
Well, thank you, Nancy, and I hope you come back here again to WGXE to tell it like it is. Thank you so much for taking the time to be here this morning, and thank you for what you did.
Thanks, Christina, and thanks for what you do.
Thanks. And I want to do a quick shout-out to the people who are right now being arrested, have begun the arrests and are continuing protests against the XL pipeline. A shout-out to Bill McKibben and all the people who are out there doing that. Okay, join us next week for another edition of Tell It Like It Is. Talk to you soon.
Hi, I'm Ashley Lair from Germantown, New York. You're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, Acra, Hudson, Catskill. Hands-on and listener-supported radio.
This is Al Jazeera English, broadcast exclusively on the Pacifica Radio Network.
This is Al Jazeera.
I'm Derin Abu Gaida in Doha. The top stories. $1.6 million to bring in Muammar Gaddafi, dead or